Well, James, we are back again on The Way They Went, a gentle, nurturing celebration of the lives and deaths of some immense cultural icons in some cases. We are seeking mirth in the macabre and the fun at funerals. No easy task, which is why these recordings are both essential to science and modern discourse, and also indescribably tedious. It's quite a skill getting that balance. So here we go again.
As you've alluded to, the emotional intensity of recording these things, I think, is probably taking its toll a little bit on me. But I'm happy with that because at the end of the day, I also find it hilarious.
Good. I think that's the spirit. You know, spirit of the Blitz. We've got to see this through now we've started. I have got a good one today, I think. So let's get straight on with the drama. Let's get you, as usual, to see if you can guess my subject. We'll see how many clues you need. Today, our lens turns to a star of the big screen who lived a life that could be safely described as colourful. So this is a gentleman actor. Born in February 1938 in London, did national service in the Royal Army Medical Corps. These are fairly obscure clues so far. I don't expect you to have a guess now, but if you want to.
Well, there's not a lot to go on there, really, is it? But we're talking about, I suppose, a kind of golden age of Hollywood, are we? The timeline there. So I'm thinking Arthur Askey initially.
No. He would have been born way before that. He was a star in the 30s and 40s. Anyway. So this gentle person, he started his professional acting career as an extra, playing bit parts in the late 50s, started to make his name in the early to mid 60s, and became a pretty big star by the late 60s, mid 70s. And then by the 1980s, his career was largely in the toilet. Let's look at some of his screen credits to really focus you in. He was in bit part in The League of Gentlemen, 1959. Remember that one?
Nope, I don't remember that one.
Okay, that was a good film. I remember it. Not at the time, obviously. It was 16 years before I was born. But he was in various Hammer horror films. He worked with Michael Winner and Ken Russell. And here's a big clue now. This is a big clue. If you're a fan of this person, you will get it from this. In 1969, he shot a famous, or probably infamous would be better, full frontal nude man-on-man wrestling scene in Ken Russell's film Women in Love.
Wow. So not only did he work with Ken Russell, but he also had the privilege of working with Michael Winner in some great films. I'm thinking I might know who this is, but I think I need a little bit more to go on because you describe that man-on-man scene. And obviously I think I've seen that film, well, that particular scene, 200 to 300 times now, really just as an artistic research avenue or an indulgence, I think my therapist would call it. But you carry on, because I think I'm very near. That description brought very starkly to mind some buttocks. So I think I might have identified the buttocks, but I need a bit more help with the man.
Buttocks and so much more, yes. I mean, you know, it's quite a scene, that one. I mean, it's a splendid display of homoeroticism, which in 1969 on screen was probably pretty risky. But so let's move on. I mean, he's got a huge back catalogue of films and TV. Mostly I've never heard of it, of course, well before my time. It's very tempting to dismiss it all as total rubbish, so I will. Let's skip to arguably his most famous part, made him a huge star, playing the villainous Bill Sykes in the classic film version of Oliver, which was called Oliver in 1968. Thoughts?
Well, I think we might be a little bit nearer. I was thinking it could be David Jason, but then I remembered it's just his career that's died and not he hasn't actually physically died. So I had to rule him out. I'm thinking that would I be right in saying that this person's kind of last role in the film was helped and aided by computer-generated imagery?
That is correct, and we will be talking about that a little bit. Yeah.
And would I be right in saying that this man liked the occasional tipple?
He was known for enjoying a beverage, a libation or two.
So I think I do know who it is. Would you want me to have a stab at it now?
Go on, yeah.
Well, I think on previous podcasts, we have talked about The Three Musketeers, haven't we, as a film. And we talked about the late, great Roy Kinnear. And this guy, I think, was one of the Musketeers. And I think we're talking about Oliver Reed.
Correct. Yes, well done. This is, in fact, Robert Oliver Reed. He was in Three Musketeers, The Four Musketeers, and the other sequel. For me, that was his greatest on-screen performance, actually. He played Athos in those films, 73, 74, and he was absolutely superb in those roles. He was at the height of his powers and physicality. And as you say, we've already discussed those a little bit related to the tragic demise of Roy Kinnear. But as you also hinted at, it's actually his final film role that interests us most today because it's linked in a way to his death. You obviously recall his final film role.
I think he was Jeremy the Carpenter in Russell LaRocque's Gladiator, is that right?
Close, yeah. He was Proximo, the slave owner and retired gladiator in the hit movie about a gladiator, which was called Gladiator. 1999, Russell Crowe and Ridley Scott. I mean, it was an epic film, wasn't it? Soundtrack, great action sequences, plot intrigue, and that hint of incest that keeps the audience really engaged.
Were there buttocks in that film? I can't remember.
Oh, I should think there were. I can't remember either, but I
mean, we'll have to have another look.
Yeah, we'd have to watch it very closely. Fantastic film, and he genuinely gave a superb performance in that. But due to his demise, which we will come on to in its glorious detail, the last scenes involving him had to be computer-generated or replaced with body doubles and so on, and they very cunningly wove that in and made it work. But just before we get onto that, how many famous Olivers can you name?
Wow, there's obviously the Dickens Oliver that you've mentioned. So does he count, the character Oliver?
Well, you'd have to give his surname as well, really, to score that point.
Smudgeon?
Oliver Twist. Have you never read a book?
Oh, that's right, yeah. Twist.
Okay.
I'll make a note of that.
Six
famous Olivers. Okay, I'll have another go. Let's see who else I could. Oliver Postgate, the puppeteer and children's program creator who was famous for... Ivor, the Juggernaut, things like that.
I will tentatively accept that as a famous Oliver because I have heard of him.
Oliver Gielgud? Oh no, that was Lawrence, wasn't it? No.
Yes, you're thinking of Lawrence.
John. Gielgud. That's right. It's not easy, is it, to come up with famous Olivers? No, you're going to have to help me. Go on, go through the list.
Okay. Number one, Oliver Cromwell.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Number two, Oliver Stone, film director. Number three, Oliver Hardy.
Of course.
And then we've already got Oliver Reed and Oliver Twist. And the last one is Bath Olivers, the faintly revolting dry biscuit.
Ah, yes. And that's, I guess that's the, not only is that a definitive list, but it's also fairly uncontroversial. I like what you did there was picked out a couple of things that people could not argue against. So, you know, one being a dry biscuit and the other being a fairly strong-headed despot.
Let's get back to our favourite Oliver. Mr. Reed, to his great regret, and this was a matter that he raised many times in his, you know, in interviews and articles and so on, he was generally best known as a drunken hellraiser, and his reputation for drinking and roughhousing eclipsed his film and TV performances in the public mind. I think true fans of his would dispute that, but, you know, in the public perception, that's what he was best known for. And he especially became notorious for drunken antics on chat shows. And I'm going to go through some of these performances in a minute, and they really are worth another look in many cases. But just before that, it has been suggested, and this is interesting, see what you think of this, it's been suggesting that some of these capers were a deliberate ploy to raise publicity. And it was also said of Richard Burton, another famous Hellraiser, you know, the actor, that if the ticket sales to his latest show were flagging, he would go out on the lash, what me and my schoolmates used to call an ELF, an 11-hour lager frenzy. And he would get into the tabloids, and the press then would inevitably mention that he was starring as Hamlet or King Lear or whatever, and the ticket sales would go up. What do you think of that?
Well, I think it's an interesting kind of strategy, isn't it? I don't know what kind of evidence there is in relation to... the films that he was in. But I guess the other factor is, I don't know whether that behavior and that sort of image that he created of, you know, the sort of hell-raising drunk and, the man that immediately you spot when you go into a pub. I don't know if that influenced the roles that he was offered or maybe his sort of roles on scene. I guess that's another thing to think about, isn't it? You know, I guess if he was a bit hungover or desperately seeking the cooking sherry, that could have had a bearing. But there's a possible PR strategy there, isn't there? Not a great one, but, you know, it's that old thing about, you know, no publicity is bad publicity, isn't it?
Yeah, the oxygen of publicity and all that. Well, I mean, it's worth noting that there was a bit of a scene in the 1960s around this group of British actors known to be Hellraisers, of which Oliver Reed was the doyen. The others were Richard Burton, as I've mentioned, Peter O'Toole, Richard Harris, all, you know, hard drinking scrappers who would be out boozing all night and then turn up on set at 10 a.m. the next morning and knock people down with their breath, I should imagine. But let's have a look at some of his boozy antics, because this will also give you a feel for the tone of his demise. But just before we get onto that, a point worth bearing in mind, I'm going to prick your conscience now. And if you're going to have something pricked, I'd probably choose conscience first. A point worth bearing in mind is that he was an alcoholic. It's a serious illness. You know, we've got to be mindful of that. So whether or not you admire someone and enjoy the story of someone drinking 106 pints of beer on a two-day binge the day before he got married, whether you enjoy that or whether you condemn them for that sort of behaviour, we should remember that to some extent these antics are the product of a disease.
I think that's a really salient point, and I think that people listening to this should be fully aware that we are not judging in any way this man who just happened to be a fall-down drunk.
And that's well put, James. And if anybody finds any of these antics, which I'm about to recount, in any way amusing, they should be thoroughly ashamed of themselves.
That's right.
So what did he get up to? Well, so I was doing a bit of research to find out what he'd been up to. The first story that seemed to come up was that he went on a big night out with Steve McQueen and puked all over him. He had a glass of whiskey poured over his head on a chat show for his controversial comments. He shot a farmer through the hand in South Africa. There's a lot to say about that, but I'm going to move on straight away. Whilst filming in Toronto, 1979, he took an extended lunch break. His lunch consisted of 5 bottles of wine. He felt a bit hot. He decided to walk back to his hotel without his trousers or pants on in December in Canada. He was stopped by the police, and in what I like to think of as typical Canadian fashion, he was politely escorted back to his hotel room.
That's quite a scene, isn't it? There, it's quite a scene that you've described, him sort of strutting back, you know, debagged, as it were.
Can you imagine the cops pulling over and saying, are we all right, sir? And he said, yes, I've just had a bit of a lunch and I'm feeling rather hot. You know, -8 or something.
I do remember at some point, you might come onto this, but did he molest, similar to Emu, I think, that we talked about before on this podcast, but did he molest Russell Harty at some point?
These antics I'm going through now are some of his sort of general binge antics. And then I've got a separate list in a sec of his TV show appearance antics, which I know the one you're thinking of. We'll come on to that. But excellent. just another couple or so of his sort of general antics. He had a huge home in Surrey in the 1970s, a huge sort of mansion. I mean, he was a very wealthy man, very successful. He threw some infamous parties, and one of them included inviting 30 members of his local rugby club over for drinks. They started off the night meeting at the pub with a naked run from the pub to the house, all 30 of them, 31 of them. And by the end of the night, the group had apparently consumed 50 gallons of beer, that's 400 pints or 13 each, 32 bottles of whiskey, 17 bottles of gin, and 4 crates of wine.
So basically a branch of threshers, I think, is probably the collective term for all of that. And they went on a naked run.
To start the evening off, they ran naked from the pub to his house just to get things going.
Just to get the thirst going, was that?
Yeah. And the girlfriend of one of the rugby players said that it's worse than it sounds, because a number of the players who came to the party were actually in training and weren't drinking. So the others actually, you know, kind of had to make up for it. There's another story of another party at home on New Year's Eve when Oliver and his girlfriend at the time were entertaining a group, and he was getting more and more restless waiting for midnight to come round. So he manually turned the clock hands around to 12. Shouted Happy New Year and then blew the clock off the wall with a shotgun.
What a man to have at a party.
What a host.
There's probably people out there sort of reminiscing, I guess, about, you know, do you remember that time that Ollie came round for New Year's Eve and blew the clock off the wall with a shotgun? Oh, how we laughed.
It must have been, terrifying. I mean, and there's a little footnote to that story, which is his then girlfriend left for good shortly after that incident.
Very quickly.
Very wisely. And then I've just got a couple of stories, 3 stories, I think, very briefly about some of his TV appearances when he may possibly have been worse for wear. The one I remember, in fact, I remember 2 of these 3, The first one was when he went on The Word, the TV show The Word. Do you remember that?
Oh, very well. I remember that very well, yes. I remember that particular... I think I was actually watching that live when it was going on.
Me too, yeah. So they locked him in a room with about six bottles of vodka, and then they secretly filmed him to see what he'd get up to. And obviously he drank a lot of this vodka and became increasingly you know, confused. I kind of remember that, and he kind of had a leather jacket on with his sort of gut hanging out with no shirt underneath. He became increasingly sort of ranting, and I've since read up on it, and apparently he answered interview questions with complete gibberish and then performed an incomprehensible cover of Wild Thing with Ned's Atomic Dustbin.
Yeah, I do remember him sort of jumping onto the stage at some point, a bit like a Space Invader. You know, if you can imagine how Space Invaders used to move in the old arcade game, that was his sort of stance. And I remember his garb, his get-up as well. He was dressed very much like a sort of Hell's Angel from, you know, like the Blue Oyster Bar or something. I seem to remember he had a leather hat as well. He looked very very dapper. But I didn't know it was Ned's doing the support role.
I mean, that alone would make you want to turn it off, I should think. He was, this is the other one I remember. He was also on Michael Aspel's chat show. What was that called? Parkinson, was it? He was interviewed about this film that he was on to plug, and he completely forgot the plot of it. He couldn't sort of recount any details about the movie, and he got a bit embarrassed, and so he sort of pranced up and down the stage. Like the old comedian Max Wall, he got the house band to play a drum beat, and he kind of minced up and down like Max Wall. And then he did exactly the same thing again on Letterman in the US, where he was on to plug the film. And he got increasingly belligerent when he got asked a question about his drinking, which apparently he'd already said he didn't want to discuss. And they had to urgently cut to commercials to get the show off air. And then the one that you might have been thinking of earlier, I don't remember this, I think it may have been in the early 80s or even the 70s, was he turned up drunk to go on a late night chat show on Channel 4, and he attempted to kiss a writer, Kate Millett, uttering the phrase, "Give us a kiss, big tits," which, you know, at the time, I think was recognised as pretty outrageous. And I think we'd now describe that as appalling sexual harassment.
You know, all of those sort of, to me, that points a question about, you know, you said that when he was on a talk show, he couldn't remember the plot or anything about the film that he'd been in. But I wonder whether, you know, to remember something, you've got to know in the first place, haven't you? Do you think that maybe he was so oblivious to the world around him because of that soaked lens that he had? Do you think he actually knew where he was and what he was doing?
Well, not all the time. There are two sides to the story, and this is interesting. There was a book written about him. A biographer wrote about him and said that he was not always as drunk as he might have appeared, and that sometimes he acted the part of the sort of, you know, the pissed up movie star at the producer's behest, you know, to liven things up. And he himself said that he knew when he was being set up, and that on The Word, he said he knew about the camera and the vodka was actually water. So who knows? All I would say is, having seen some of these things, he did not act all of that. I don't believe he was that good an actor. I think in many cases he generally was absolutely trashed.
Do you think he got stuck in that kind of persona, that character that people expected? So, you know, we mentioned, I think, previously on the podcast, we mentioned Clive Dunn, you know, for example, who I know was typecast as the sort of elderly, doddery old man, but was, you know, a bit of a hellraiser in his... in his time as well, I believe. But we can't talk about that now because obviously we're not focusing on him this time round. But do you see what I mean? Did he get stuck in that idea that people expected him to misbehave and to,
I think,
you know,
so.
Cause acts of sort of drunken and sexual violence?
I think so. I think he knew that when he was invited onto all these shows, that he was being set up, and that was the expectation, that he'd cause a bit of mayhem and everybody would love it, but he would end up looking like, you know, a prize arse. And I think he resented that. But what goes hand in hand with that was that, you know, by the kind of mid to late 80s and certainly into the 90s, his career was kind of on the rocks, you know, pretty heavily. And, you know, that must be difficult for anybody to take as well. So, you know, I do feel sorry for him in that respect. And as we've already mentioned, he was an alcoholic. So give him a couple of drinks, of course, he's going to go mad. I hope by now, James, that you've got a sufficient flavour for his notoriety. And perhaps now is the time to move on to the demise.
I can smell the fumes of his history from here.
I'm going to take you back to the 2nd of May, 1999. We're going to Valletta in Malta, capital of Malta, during a break from filming Gladiator. I'm not sure this was an official break. I think Ollie decided it was a break. So he was in a bar called The Pub, having a couple of drinks. And in the bar with him was a group of young sailors on shore leave from HMS Cumberland. And they were chatting and joking, messing around, having a good time. And it's reported that Oliver Reed drank, here's the list, at least 8 pints of strong German lager, possibly more, 12 double shots of rum, half a bottle of Irish whiskey, and several shots of Hennessy cognac. That's his personal consumption, which is verified. During this, they had a bit of an arm wrestling contest, him against these young lads, and he won 5 matches in a row. He insisted on paying for the drinks, which came to a total of 270 Maltese lira, which is £450, or about $600 at that time. He then suddenly, inexplicably, collapsed. He suffered a heart attack and essentially died on the way to hospital. And that was kind of it, you know, textbook hellraiser, aged only 61. What a way to go.
He must have been highly flammable at that point as well, I imagine. That list of alcohol that you just reeled off there, he must have, anyone who probably lit a cigarette near him would have potentially blown the bar.
I think if they had tried to cremate him within 24 hours, there would have been an explosion.
I think that's highly possible.
But there's a footnote, James, and this is very touching. You'll like this. Mm. In honour of both Oliver Reed and unbelievably crass commercialism, the pub has since subtitled itself Ollie's Last Pub and sells Oliver Reed-related souvenirs, including candles, mugs, plates, T-shirts and bookmarks that display his picture.
I think that's a really touching and fitting tribute, isn't it? You know, they're clearly not just cashing in on, you know, a sort of sad, violent episode that went on.
Tragic.
Tragic episode that went on there. They're making some money, you know, so presumably at some point they'll make enough to replace all the furniture that he smashed to pieces in his drunken rage.
He smashed all the furniture to pieces, ground it down into a powder, and then drank it. That's what happened. I think that's what he used to do. He went out like a firework, didn't he? I mean, how else would he have passed away? I can't think of any more fitting tribute to him than his own demise. You know, the method of his own demise. I mean, it's just absolutely textbook.
He wasn't going to fizzle out, was he? Really? Let's be honest.
He went out with a bang. I mean, at least eight pints of German lager, strong lager. 12 double shots of rum, half a bottle of whiskey, several shots of Hennessy, an arm wrestling contest with 5 sailors, which he won, paid for the drinks, then collapsed and died.
And obviously perfectly preserved as well, you know, perfectly pickled. So I believe he's in a museum somewhere in Valletta, is he now?
Completely impenetrable to the forces of nature due to the preservative effects of all that booze, which, of course, you know, flows from a disease and an illness, and we have to temper our enjoyment of his passing with a moment of reflection, I think, on, you know, the sadness of that disease. So that is very sad. But, James, that is the way he went.
Hello, I'm Jack Humphreys.
I'm Danny Denson.
And this time we're going to talk to you all about being poorly and maybe visiting a special place. When many people feel a little the dark side of chipper, they attend a hospital, a sort of hotel with ointment.
When staying in hospital, always give a passing nurse a friendly pat on the buttocks. But remember to wash your hands afterwards. She may be as dirty as a Spaniard.
Many of our hospitals are staffed by highly trained physicians from across the empire, like my cousin Rupert, or Dr. Rupert Bungfelcher, to be exact, leading expert on chronic kidney exuberance.
You must smoke at least 60 cigarillos per day to stave off tuberculosis, diphtheria, and a dash of the whoopsies.
There are many reasons you might be prescribed a short sojourn. Mild rheumatoid prejudice, a tree fungus infection, coits or sailor's rope disease, or an uncivil bowel. All should take at least 2 to 3 weeks of being laid up with strong meals to sort you out.
The food round here is simply ghastly, so mind you don't get a case of the galloping shakes. I recommend £2 of Dundee cake for breakfast and plenty of duck fat under the armpits, morning, noon and night, just like mother.
For some poorer folk, they have to endure more rudimentary treatment on the National Illness Stipend. You can expect coal tar soap, rusty screws, and blackout with a brick.
If you do suffer a case of the two bob bits and can't make it to the latrine for a quick Richard III, you must use your neighbour's bedside cabinet and simply pretend that you're a Scotchman. Try and cut down on the old fire water while you're convalescing. Matron has limited my intake to a couple of stiff tots of good brandy once every quarter of an hour. A pretty Spartan regime, but I am here for health reasons after all.
Sometimes people like to receive a gift when they end up in hospital. A bowl of figs, some jumbo blimbos, or 12 tins of badger tripe.
If you do get the shakes, feel free to try a couple of emergency nips of any industrial-grade anaesthetic or liquid morphine that you find lying around in carefully locked storerooms. Absolutely delicious. Jack, are you sure that man was a doctor? He absolutely reeked of brown ale.
Well, let's hope so, Danny, given where he put his hands.
Filthy brute.
That's it this time for our sterling advice if you end up in the old hospital. Stay safe, and we'll see you again soon.
Pip, pip.
Okay, so we're now going to move to the figure that I want to bring to the table here about, really about, I suppose, a legend of our popular culture. So this will touch, I think, Dave, on your love of some of this music, because I know, you know, having known you for a few weeks, I know that you are a big fan of folk music and particularly sort of popularized folk music as well. So we're talking about a singer-songwriter who also was an actor and an activist and also a record producer. So he did quite a lot in his time across a number of different elements of show business, the business they call show. And actually, it's probably worth stating here that he recorded and released over 300 songs and sold in his time over 33 million records. So we're talking here about a real player in the game of minority folk pop music. So I hope you're furiously taking some notes as we go through this. And I'm going to give you another key fact and then see if you've got any ideas about who this person may be. And the key fact's important here because I know previously we've had feedback from people who've listened and they've said, you don't take these things seriously. You put in ridiculous conspiracy theories. Some of your facts are highly questionable. So we've taken that on board. And in the spirit of that, I want to put this fact on the table for you. Now, this guy that we're talking about was born in Roswell, New Mexico in 1943. Okay, so the word Roswell, I think, is a trigger, and there will be some people listening to this who instantly will type in the code and activate the sequence. Okay, I'm not really saying any more than that at this point, but Dave, I bring you in. Have you any idea who this could be?
No, and I'm deeply concerned references to the code and the secret. Let's just glibly move past that. This is a folk singer. He's sold over 30 million records. My first thought was Bob Dylan, but I don't think Bob Dylan's dead. And I think he was possibly born maybe a little earlier than that. No, I'm sorry, I don't know. Keep going.
I'll continue. He is a person who, in his younger life, moved around America a lot. Partly because as a child, his father was in the United States Air Force and therefore got posted all over the country and all over the world in different assignments. And often I think people have cited that as, you know, he has this kind of hobo, kind of nomadic quality in his music about perhaps thinking about home and where home is and, you know, sort of thinking about our relationship to the woodsman. You know, all that kind of stuff. So he is also someone who played his first guitar at the age of 11. So he started fairly young. But as you know, I've been playing probably from the age of about 3. And the C chord now is something I've mastered. So I'm quite proud of that. He is a figure who mainly, he started out playing in trios and bands and choirs. But we know him best, I think, as a solo artist. And he's probably most successful in his solo career. He's also appeared, you might get it from this clue, he's also appeared in 2 Muppets Christmas specials. So he was a big fan and friend of Jim Henson and also Felt, Pigs and Frogs.
I was about to say, I mean, you've thrown me with a Muppets reference, because that's a total blank for me. I was immediately thinking Michael Caine when he said that. Before you threw that curveball in, I was thinking John Denver.
Well, you might be quite close there in terms of it is actually John Denver. So very, very well done. Very well done. And now, I don't know if you know this about John Denver, that in 1985, he personally asked if he could take part in the amazing pop phenomenon that was We Are the World. Remember We Are the World? It was a bit like Band-Aid, but in the States, yeah. And he was turned down.
He was probably not cool enough at the time. It was kind of, the We Are the World thing was more of a kind of a Stevie Wonder sort of urban music, fashionable stuff, whereas I think probably John Denver was a little bit uncool. He was a bit sort of folk, almost country at the time, and a bit unfashionable. That would be my...
They told him that it didn't fit into the pop and rock ethos of the record. I think that's what they told him. But I think he was a bit put out by it, to be honest, and it obviously affected some of his fingering on his later releases. His first album, I don't know if you know his first album. I know you've got an extensive range of music somewhere in your shed. Would you want to have a guess at the title of his first album in 1969?
Look, how many people are massive John Denver fans do you think that are still going today? I mean, you know, not very many. What was his first album? I don't know. Was it called Live with John Denver or something like that?
No, very close. It was called Rhymes and Reasons. Okay, Rhymes and Reasons, a lovely title, I think,
awesome.
For a beautiful record there. And we're going to talk about the way he went, okay? Because there's a very disturbing link between the song he was probably most famous for and the way he departed, okay? Now, you might know some of this because it's not that long ago. It was in 1997, sadly, that he left this mortal coil. And one of the songs that was popularized by Peter, Paul and Mary was Leaving on a Jet Plane. Okay, so they had a hit with that song originally, which probably now people know as a John Denver song, don't they? They probably wouldn't know that Peter, Paul and Mary had a stab at it first, but that was the track that helped him, I guess, get on the ladder and get, you know, where he got. As I say, there's a really poignant message, I think, in that song. And again, going back to the Roswell connection, you may remember the code, please. You may be able to, when you listen to that song, see snapshots of the future and determine things that haven't yet quite happened. I know, certainly from my experience, it is possible to bend time in that way. But we're going to move on to how he left us. So on the 12th of October in 1997, he decided to take out his new home-built plane. Okay, so we're not talking about something that he put together with Tupperware or anything like that. It was one of these kind of planes that you can buy and put together. It was a Rutan Long Easy. Does that mean anything to you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I've owned many of those myself. But forgive me if I'm wrong, James, but I suspect there's a fatal flaw in your logic and reference to one of his two big songs, Leaving on a Jet Plane, the other one being Take Me Home, Country Roads. And other than that, an entire back catalogue of nothing. If he built the plane at home and it was one of these small sort of lightweight planes, surely that would have been a twin propeller or even a single propeller plane and not a jet plane.
You're forgetting, though, the spiritual and astral power of folk, okay? Which I believe scientists have described as equivalent to the power of a jet engine, okay?
Wow.
So I want you to keep that in your mind. So
you brought that back nicely. Yeah, okay. Okay. On that basis, then, you may proceed.
So it was a brand new plane he put together. I think he'd had some help putting some of the nuts and bolts together, some of the screws in the back of it. The previous day, he'd taken it out on a kind of half-hour test flight. He thought, yeah, I need to give it a spin. You know what it's like when you get something new and something exciting, particularly if it's a light aircraft. You want to fly it around, don't you? You're going to give it a go. So he took it out for a half hour. And the important thing about that was that he didn't replace the fuel, okay, that he'd used in that first test flight. So it was a really important factor there. He didn't replace the fuel because he thought, well, do you know what? I don't need to refuel immediately. I can do it in the next couple of days. You know, I'll have a couple of quick flights in it and then, you know, I'll get it down. Probably take it in the petrol station or the gas station, I think, as our American friends like to call it. Just wheel it in, fold the wings up, you know, that kind of thing. Take your card in the kiosk. No problem. But he didn't do that this occasion. He thought it would be fine. So A significant thing about this type of aircraft, I know you're familiar with these particular light aircrafts in some of the reconnaissance missions that you've done recently, which again, we can't talk about. There was a fuel tank selector handle on this particular model that was known to be quite difficult. Okay. And to make it even worse, whoever had helped him put together the plane had decided to make a couple of last minute adjustments to this handle, essentially. Okay, so this handle, again, I'll give listeners a kind of idea about what this handle does. You basically pull it and it releases the fuel from one of the tanks into the engine. You know, it gives a kind of the engine the fuel. Yeah, again, I'm not scientifically trained, but that's my understanding of what it does. So this handle was fairly important, I think, in terms of staying in the air, staying in the sky. And it had been moved from between the legs of the pilot to behind their shoulder. So they not only could they not easily get it if they're strapped into the plane, but also they couldn't see the gauge above it. Okay, so they couldn't tell whether they were going to run out of fuel or not. Okay, so these seem like fairly straightforward, obvious things. So we don't really know what had happened or what happened on that fatal flight, but the inference is that he instantly ran out of fuel because he either didn't notice the gauge was very low, or he got the handle stuck or couldn't locate the handle without taking his belt off, which of course is illegal, and turning over his shoulder, looking behind him in a plane, which would have had an effect on the balance and the weight of the aircraft. So I guess there's an element of negligence bordering on stupidity in some of this. As a seasoned pilot, what's your take on that scenario?
The people that helped, or the person that helped him put the plane together, was it Peter, Paul and Mary by any chance? Because what I'm thinking is, I mean, this is murder, you know, James. I mean, it seems perfectly obvious to me this is murder. Somebody has deliberately, maliciously tampered with the plane. They've moved this fuel gauge and handle out, you know, to somewhere, you know, highly suspicious, and sent him up there in a death trap. And it seems to me, you know, Peter, Paul and Mary are the obvious culprits. You know, where were they at the time?
Well, there could be something in that, couldn't there, I think? There could be an investigation in the folk scene that hasn't happened yet.
It sounds like it's long overdue, unless they were immediately arrested and given the death sentence. I don't know. I mean, perhaps you'll come on to that.
I've read that there was an adjustment made to the handle. The handle is crucial in this. And, you know, maybe out there a folk artist should maybe write a song about John Denver pulling his handle before he met Jesus. I don't know. I mean, it's an idea that I'm going to put out there. But I believe the handle was adapted with a pair of pliers, i.e. it was bent slightly to allow it to be manoeuvred more easily. And just in case it didn't work, I think the pliers were left inside the aircraft as well. So, you know, that's exactly what you want, isn't it? In a time where you're out of fuel, you can't activate your secondary fuel tank, pair of pliers, try and bend the cable. There are, though, some other significant factors that I would like you to take note of here in the demise of John Denver, or real name Henry John Dutchendorf Jr. Okay, Denver was a name that he adopted as a homage to his favorite city in his favorite state. Now, the significant factors that I've alluded to are, one is that at the time of him flying, he did not have a legal permit to fly. So the flight itself wasn't licensed. He didn't have a valid license at the time, partly because, touching on the Oliver Reed style of life, I think, here, that he'd previously had several arrests for drink driving. Okay, so we should probably stress at this point that the investigation after the crash revealed that there was no alcohol or any drugs or any sign of alcohol or drugs in Denver's body, okay? But again, an unlicensed and illegal flight. And the other factor to throw in is he hadn't actually had a great deal of training to fly this kind of aircraft, okay? He'd been a pilot. He'd done lots of sort of flying around and, you know, flown various other vehicles of that kind, but not this particular model. So he was taking some risks here, but again, it goes back to that notion of the two things, I guess, that stick out for me are leaving on a jet plane, maybe as a marker. You know, as he wrote that probably 2 to 3 decades prior, but again, he knew this was going to happen, so he was kind of writing that song at that point in time. Some people would say it was coincidence, but I would dispute that. The other thing, I want to go back to it because of the code it's the Roswell connection. You know, was he actually trying to breach Earth's orbit and send a message perhaps back to the mother race?
I think in the spirit of true science, which is, you know, one we stick very closely to in these recordings, we can't rule that out. I mean, is it even confirmed for certain that he was human? I mean, you know, you say he was born in Roswell, New Mexico. Maybe that's just where he was discovered, and that his entire life was one of, you know, covert surveillance and, you know, the most effective way for him to gather data and information about how to ultimately bring about the demise of humankind, you know, was under the auspices of a, you know, a moderately successful folk singer. And that's the way to really get into the, you know, the nuts and bolts of how to bring down humanity. And that this was his demise, allegedly, was, you know, just a way of disappearing legitimately so that he could go and report on what he discovered. And our imminent, total destruction is on the way.
There's also the factor I mentioned earlier about the Muppets. Okay, the Muppets may be significant in this, because some of the scenes, I think, in those Christmas specials were quite distressing, but some did involve Gonzo. Okay, now Gonzo of all the Muppets is known to be the one without a passport. Okay, so we know also from films like Muppets from Space that there are, let's just say, extraterrestrial factors in his demise that aren't explained.
So this whole thing runs very, very deep, doesn't it? Yeah, I mean, I'm with you, James. I can see that you've got to read a lot more into this than a simple tragic accident brought about by, you know, messing about in a light aircraft. So have you got notes on what actually happened, you know, right at the sort of terminal moment, or is there a good recounting of what happened, or did he just sort of disappear? Was the aircraft ever found and that sort of thing?
Well, there are, yes, the aircraft was found and parts of the aircraft were found, including a mirror, which was added to the aircraft as an adaptation so that he could try and see the handle or the fuel gauge without turning round. Okay, so again, people knew it was as an issue. There are some eyewitness testaments, if you like, where a number of people said they saw the plane banking steeply and then sort of veering right, suggesting that he was really struggling with the handle at the last point. And then a number of people reported at the time of hearing a kind of backfiring noise and then the engine kind of cutting out just before it crashed into the sea. Okay, so it landed somewhere in Monterey Bay near Pacific Grove, California. So, yeah, we do have debris and we do have parts. And I believe a body was recovered as well. Unlike other folks from Roswell, where, you know, the whereabouts of bodies, let's just say that, is very shadowy, isn't it? I know certainly some of those books that you lent me suggests that.
Well, fascinating, James, fascinating. And that was in 1997.
1997. And there is, I think, just finally, there is, I think, something that gives credence to some of these theories around John Denver, where in 2007, so fairly recently, Rocky Mountain High was made one of the Colorado State's official songs. Okay, it was made one of their official songs, which really, I think, kind of endorses some of his philosophy or some of the questions that he asked. So I think a lot of thinking to do after we've considered the late John Denver, but that is exactly the way he went.